It is National Poetry Month, and to celebrate, we welcome one of our favorites to the program this morning. Jerul Marbrook will tell us about his latest collection, Riding Thermals to Winter Grounds. Jerul was born in Algiers, grew up in New York. He served in the U.S. Navy for many years, was a newspaper reporter and editor. His awards include the Wick Poetry Prize and the International Book Award in Poetry. He hails from New York's Mid-Hudson Valley, and we couldn't be more thrilled to welcome him back to the roundtable this morning. How are you?
I'm fine, Joe, and I'm delighted to be here.
Very nice to have you back on the program. It's been a while. Tell us about the new collection. It's always wonderful to read your work, and so to have a collection of new poems is quite a gift.
This is my fifth book of poetry, and its origin is an encounter with an eagle on Overlook Mountain. That's the mountain that overlooks Woodstock to the south and Sorgetes to the north. And I was on a ledge behind a ruined hotel, and this eagle was circling on top of a thermal, you know, those warm columns that birds like to ride.
Right.
And he kept coming closer and closer because I imagine the thermal was sort of wobbling toward the ledge. And finally, the eagle and I looked each other in the eye. And it was sort of transformative for me in some way. And so I began writing a few poems about it. And then I realized that I had already, well, I'm an avid bird watcher, so I realized I had written quite a few other poems about encounters with birds of prey, mostly. So that's the origin of Riding Thermals to Winter Grounds, and then I began to realize that my old age is a bit like the bird riding the thermals.
Mm.
And I began to meditate on that thought.
It is really something that struck me in the collection is that we have a place on a lake, and it is, we have, from what I count, anywhere from 3 to 5 eagles that are there regularly. And as you said, that is a transformative experience because I can't stop watching them. I mean, that is a day for me of just going and watching. And you talk about this, just the eye that they have, of what they are able to see from so far above and to take in. And it does change you, doesn't it?
Yes, I thought so. The first experience I had was sailing by a bell buoy in the Potomac River, and there were some ospreys who had nested in. And I was standing on the deck managing our sails, and I found myself staring into the eye of this osprey. And it's such an incredible stare. It almost goes right through you. And you know that bird is seeing much more than you will ever see. Because her life depends on it.
I'm hoping you can read one of the poems in the collection for us.
I will.
How do you want to set this up?
Well, I have a rather short, I have two poems that I selected. One is only about 8 lines, and the other is maybe about 16 lines. Do you have a preference? Or?
No, you can read them both, actually.
All right. This one, I think this speaks to our times and to our body politic, maybe. Mm. It's called Double Agents. Depends which way a mouth is pointing, whether a brain lets words in. Words have their own magnetic north, double agents in service to their own gods. So watch the triangulation of a mouth and the way it shapes intent, because all words shift shape and sail their own currents, no matter which way mind blows.
Mm. All words shift shape. When was that written? How long ago was that written?
I think this is one of the poems that I had written before the encounter with the eagle. And as I began to structure the book, it seemed to me that certain of those poems were in concert with what I wanted to say about my old age, I like to think that in my old age I see more like the eagle, not because my sight is improving, but because my inner sight or my third eye is improving. And I not only see more about life, I think, but I'm more willing to confront what I see. I think there's always the temptation when we're young or even in the middle of our careers to go along to get along. And we see things, but we don't confront them because they're not convenient or because they're dangerous to confront.
The third eye, as you call it, could that not be referred to as wisdom?
Yes, I think that's another way, another way of
experience,
of looking at it, yes.
Jalil Marbrook is our guest. We're talking about his new collection of poetry, Riding Thermals to Winter Grounds, and he just read to us Double Agents. And the next poem, also about words.
Well, here's another poem about words. And the title is Words, comma, Do Not Trust the Page. So it would read, Words, do not trust the page. To protect them from predators. They see themselves as naked slaves in a cruel marketplace. I do not blame them and confess to be their enemy. They want to be bonfires or at least to do their part. We gather for separate purposes, wanting warmth more than light, and words do not like our preferences. In our huddling and our wars, we do not notice them abandoning their posts and going over to the enemy only they have known about. The terrible loss of having to speak, the primitivist instinct that compels us to enslave and write endless white papers, absolving us from the hideous sin of shackling them to the page.
That's beautiful. Words do not trust the page.
I think that comes a little bit from my newspaper experience. When I was I had been a reporter, and I wanted to understand how newspapers are made. So I took a job in Elmira, New York, with the Elmira Star Gazette, which was actually the first Gannett newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And I had it was a unionized composing room. And in a unionized composing room, an editor absolutely cannot, under any circumstances, touch the type. All that has changed now because we've gone to offset, and then from hot lead to offset, and now we've gone to the digital era. But for some reason, I had this grand compulsion to pick up a 42-point headline. And the shop foreman looked at me in horror. He could have called a chapel meeting in protest of the editor having violated this terrible rule. But he didn't because he knew that I was an old union man myself and had been a union activist. So he didn't want to lay that trip on me because he knew I was in sympathy with the union. And I held that headline in my hand. It was still warm because it had been hot lead. And it was a life-changing experience. I said, oh, my God, I'm holding a word in my hands. And, you know, for the rest of my life, I've meditated on that idea of holding a word in our hands. We treat words without reverence very often. I think that's often true and more true in television than it is in the print media. We don't have a sufficient reverence for them.
I can't help but make the political leap, which is we seem now to have trouble with the true meaning of words now. We're going through a period.
I think that's true.
Which is difficult.
I think that's true. And very often when I give a reading, I wouldn't say that I horrify the audience, but I certainly raise eyebrows when I tell them that that poetry is the real news of our society, and what we call the news is the appearance the ephemera of society, the disguises of news. But I tell them that I think that's why the punditocracy is always trying to bury poetry, always writing stories that ask, is poetry dead? Because intuitively they know that poetry is willing to confront truth. And poetry is at the very furthest edge of our sensibility, and to some extent fiction as well, particularly literary fiction. And it disquiets audiences, and I see why it disquiets them, because the media now, the news media, are held in low esteem, according to the polls. And I, as an old newspaper man, think deservedly so. I hate to say that, but I think it is true. And I think poetry is just simply willing to tell it more like it is, if you listen carefully, than the media are. The media are more inclined to beat around the bush, more inclined to be influenced by the advertisers, more inclined to be interested by the banks that finance them, you know, that by Wall Street. And I think we've reached a kind of a low point in I'll give you an example. It's Russiagate, the Trump-Russia story. I mean, here we have the media whining and groaning about the unverifiability of the allegations against Trump and the American right. Well, it's the media who ought to be investigating. Mm. I mean, what right do they have to whinge and whine about the unverifiability? It's their job to verify or to disprove. So I think that we're at a low point now, but not so with poetry, I think. I think a lot of the poets are willing to confront the very things that the media are beating around the bush about.
Is it because it comes in, and I use this word hesitantly, but because the poet's words come in a somewhat more abstract way, where we look at it and through our lens we interpret it, which is different than seeing the words very clear in black and white, where there is a little wiggle room. Does that make sense?
Yes, I think that is true, and I think the media, in all fairness to them, are limited by what A.J. Liebling called the edemoni-cademoni phenomenon. You know, having to balance this against that,
right?
Having to balance the pro against the con, and the poets, of course, they don't face any strictures like that at all.
You came to poetry late, really.
Very late. I was hoping you would ask me that question.
Well, it's 2007, so you've been doing this for 10 years.
That's right. I started writing when I was 14, Joe. And in my I had a breakdown in my third year in college, and one of the aspects of the breakdown was what they call spotty amnesia. So one day when I was working at this job as the Sunday editor in Winston-Salem, I came into work. My life had been very stressful and my first marriage was failing. And I sat down just at a big desk, just like we're sitting here, and I couldn't remember a damn thing about my job. I simply could not remember how to do the job. Then I realized later that morning that I couldn't remember how to do a whole bunch of tasks, very important tasks. So I got into therapy for the first time in my life. And at some point in my therapy, I was talking to the therapist about my poetry. And she said, tell me about it. You'd rather be a poet than a newspaper man. And I said, well, I've tried to do both, but it's kind of hard. And I said, and I still don't know what made me say it. I said, I think I realize now that I don't want to be caught dead saying what I mean, and I don't want to be caught dead meaning what I say in poetry. And that's why my poetry is what I called experimental. It was today we might call it language poetry or constructivist poetry, poetry that is more concerned with the actual nature of language and the appearance of the work on the page. And I'm an admirer of that kind of poetry, but I also realized at that point that I had been engaged in that kind of poetry because I really didn't want to say what I meant, and I really didn't want to be caught saying it. So I gave up poetry in my 30s. I simply just gave it up. And I never wrote another word of poetry again until 9/11, until the attacks. And I had gone down to New York to try to come to terms with the horror of the attacks. And I was walking around the city, and I was taking notes in a little blue notebook. And I did that for days and days. And I went home one night, and I was sitting and reading my notes, and I realized that I had been writing poetry. It had some prosodic discipline. It even had slant rhyme and assonance, and it had all the aspects of poetry. And I was sort of astonished, really. And after that, I began writing poetry again, very late in my life. I was an old man.
Do you think, first of all, going back to the amnesia, that has to scare the hell out of you?
It did. It did.
I mean, that would, seems to me something that would shake you to your core, of not remembering what you have lived.
It happened at I'm not exactly sure when the first incident of it was. It typically can come in when you're an adolescent. The first time I remembered it happening, I was finishing my third year at Columbia. It was a sunny day, May 19th, and I was standing in front of Butler Library on 116th Street. And I looked around, and I literally said to myself, "Where the hell am I?" I had just been in a class. I put down my books. I used to carry them tied up in a belt. Kids did that back then. And I put it on a bench. I took off my baseball jacket, and I wrapped it around my books very carefully. I have no idea why I did this. And I left them on that bench. I never saw Columbia again. And I struggled for days with that amnesia till I recovered enough of myself. And I shipped out in the Merchant Marine for a few months at that point. And that was good. The sea did me a lot of good. But it has afflicted me again and again throughout my life. I always have to watch out for signs of it.
I'm curious. Without getting overly personal, but how did the therapist react when you stopped writing and you stopped conveying these thoughts through poetry or even journaling and putting in a diary? Because I would think that would, as a person in therapy, they very much encourage you to write down as much as you can.
She thought it was an overly theatrical and romantic act. She was, and self-destructive. But later, many years later, when I was involved with another therapist in Washington, he had a different take. He said, "I think at that point you began to prick your own pomposity. You began to deflate your own pomposity." And the moment he said that, I remembered that wonderful Hitchcock movie, Strangers on a Train, where Robert Walker is walking around in a fair and he's smoking a cigarette, and he pops a kid's balloon with his cigarette. It was a mean act, but it was also wonderful in a way because it was just naked meanness, you know. And this second therapist said, I think when you stopped writing poetry, you had become aware of your own pomposity, your own self-importance, and you were horrified that you were writing dishonestly, because I was hiding myself in the poetry. afraid to say what I meant.
Did that have Jewel Marbrook, by the way, as our guest? We're talking about his new collection, Riding Thermals to Winter Grounds, and about him, of course. Did that have an effect? We talk about the effect that had on your poetry. How did it affect the day job? How did it affect your journalism?
I think I became a little more difficult for my publishers to handle. for example,
well, isn't that part of the job, though?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's a point at which you begin to shoot yourself in the foot. On the other hand, if you're bold, that can work in your favor too. I think that it was that same month that I said to the publisher at an editorial meeting, I don't think we should be putting the bestseller list on the book review page. I think it should be on the business page because it's a business measure. It's not a measure of merit. It's a measure of market over merit. Well, of course, the advertising director and the publisher were outraged and furious with me. Not because they felt that I was nuts, but because they knew I was right. But being right wouldn't have gotten me a cup of coffee at that point.
Right.
So I began to, challenge some of the tenets of newspapering, and that worked out well to a point, I felt it was a life and death matter to confront issues honestly, and that did not always work in my favor professionally.
So the idea of writing poetry now, and yes, coming to it late and over this last decade of writing poetry, and being as honest as you want to be and you can, goes perfectly with the aging process.
Yes, it does. Yes, that's the nice thing about my old age. Yeah, that I found a way to do what I knew would be a life and death issue for me. And I had been an abused child. I had grown up in a boarding school where there was a lot of not only sexual abuse, but a lot of bullying and a lot of craven behavior on the part of adults. So I was traumatized, and I think confronting those things rather than covering for the adults and covering for my own family became a life and death issue for me. It seemed to me that if I didn't do that, that I would die.
Is the struggle, as you struggle and you have these, let's say, episodes of going through the struggles of your life, is it worth it to get to this point, which is so freeing?
Absolutely. I have no question about that. Yeah, it has been worth every minute of it, really. Even the darkest moments, because I think that I found in poetry and fiction, but not in journalism, a way to turn the darkness into light. And I'm beginning to read a great deal about quantum physics and the idea of entanglements and how our entanglements, or that is our engagements in life, produce certain outcomes and certain energies. And so I look back and I see that the darkest moments of my life also produced light.
Mm. Jewel Marbrook is our guest this morning. His new collection is Riding Thermals to Winter Grounds. I can't tell you of what a treat it is and a joy to spend time with you. Thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me, Joe.
Great pleasure.
I've enjoyed this.
Thank you very much. Again, Jewel Marbrook's new book of poetry is Riding Thermals to Winter Grounds. It's from Leaky Boot Press. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.